Chris, are you there?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay, well, I'll go ahead and we'll go from there.
I do not go to work or worry a lot.
No.
'Cause the wind and the tree is all that I have got.
Okay, hold on one sec.
God.
There is kind of an echo now.
Oh, is there? Right.
No, I think it's gone.
All that I have got.
Hello again and welcome to another episode of the Fitted Furniture Makers podcast. If you're new around here, this is a place where we talk all things woodwork, but specifically fitted furniture making. So it's a bit of a niche podcast, but I do find that people from all walks of life get in touch with me. There's many people who seem to end up in this profession from different careers. And for them, it's a way out and a way to do something more creative and fulfilling than perhaps what they did before. I also hear from people who have been doing woodwork for some time and are looking to get better at it, but perhaps also to enjoy it more again and to reconcile enjoyable work with making a decent living from it, which isn't always easy in this field. So with that in mind, in this second series, we're branching out a little bit from the format of just talking to other fitted furniture makers and seeing what we can learn from them. I'm looking at how we can learn perhaps from others in related industries or even entirely different creative industries. And I think that most of us listening to this, we'd see ourselves as creative people. We're doing the work we do because it's a way to express our desire to make things and to make things for people that hopefully bring them some satisfaction as well as bringing us some satisfaction. So our guest today is a musician. It's quite possible you've heard of him. Certainly quite possible you've heard of the band that he was until recently part of. You may not have heard of his most recent project, which is how I first came across him. We'll talk more about all of this, but first let me just introduce Chris Ballew. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. It really is. And your alternative name that I first knew you by was Caspar Baby Pants.
That's right.
Yes. So, well, let me see. Where do we start? There's so much I want to ask you. Would you like to start perhaps from the beginning, however you see the beginning, and lead us to what you do now under that pseudonym?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first the earth was a molten ball of lava, and then it cooled, and then out of the pools of soup came life. I'll fast forward a little bit to 1965 when I was born, and as a 2-year-old, almost 3-year-old, I got my hands on Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by a little band called The Beatles that you might have heard of, and that album just blew my tiny mind away. I loved it so much. I listened to it exclusively, I think, for the first 8 years of my life. And then I bought a second Beatles album and listened to that.
Right. So you listened to that again and again. That must be deep in your psyche.
It is.
From that early age. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I loved about that experience of having that album worm its way into my brain is that it was a very visual experience for me. Like I saw things when they sang about, you know, Mr. Kite and Harry the Horse and lovely Rita, and everything, every character on that album came alive for me. And so it really influenced how I write songs now. I want to write songs that give people a story to listen to and a visual to, sort of focus on in their minds while they enjoy the song. And that all comes from that. So, you know, that album was kind of my inspiration, like the thing that made me want to be in that flow, and participate in that, kind of creating more of that. So, I did. Okay. And, I went to art school, but studied visual art, didn't do music, had bands. And, you know, after art school, I moved around on the East Coast, came back to Seattle. The president started up, and we just clicked. It was the right time, right place for that kind of fun rock and roll in Seattle. And I did that, but I still had this little voice in the back of my mind saying, well, this is great, but it's not it. It's not the thing you're supposed to be doing. And as I dug around, on the side more, I eventually landed on making music for little kids and parents and really felt at home there. And as evidenced by my 17 records that I have out.
Yes, you're quite prolific.
Yeah, and I have two. I have two more recorded. I have one more coming out in November, and then a last, what I think is the last one coming out when the pandemic is over. I'm going to wait and celebrate with my last album. So,
oh really?
Okay. That's kind of the arc. And then, well, to just to finish the arc and bring us up to exactly right now, I'm taking a break from songwriting and I'm doing visual art now, using my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree finally, and. Yeah, so I'm focused on visual art right now and letting the you know, creative part of music take a break. And so there you go. That's the beginning of, that's the Earth is a Molten Ball of Lava to right now.
Well, that was a fascinating overview to me, because you barely touched on what to many people would be the big thing. So
yeah. You know, right.
Your successful, I was about to say critically acclaimed. I don't know if that's true, but you're certainly very successful, very popular, very well-known band, the President of the United States of America. And you barely mentioned it, which perhaps says something about what's significant to you, because, you know, many people would be envious of the success that you had, but you said you weren't fulfilled in that. Is that right?
Well, it was fulfilling in a way, and it was definitely not in another way. It was fulfilling in that I received validation, you know, from people who were sort of at the time the gatekeepers of creativity in a way. You know, you couldn't break out into the mainstream without being on the radio, being on MTV. You know, the bottleneck was very narrow, and only a few creative people could pass through it, as opposed to now, of course, when there's this giant pipeline of the internet and everyone can jump on, have a turn at getting the attention of millions. So that part was cool. That felt good. But then once you're through that bottleneck, it's a very disorienting experience, because, you know, we went from hanging out all afternoon with our friends at home, jamming and making up songs and playing shows for fun, to all of a sudden being in charge of a multinational corporation, you know, a worldwide concern that had to get its act together and be grownups, you know. And I don't know, the world of loud grown-up rock and roll just wasn't my destination, really. And I could feel that. So personally, deep down, I could feel this sense of unease. And so I wanted to move on to the next thing. So that's why in my little arc there, I moved on so fast. Because I was like, the Presidents to me were fantastic and very validating. And I just have very fond memories and a lot of pride for what we achieved. But I also see it as a stepping stone to an ultimate destination, which was Casper Baby Pants.
Okay. That's great. And how, just briefly remaining on the Presidents of the United States of America, because I think people will be listening and interested.
Oh yeah. I don't mind talking about
it. Sure. I mean, how big were you? Cause so I have to admit, when I discovered your music as Casper, which by the way was browsing Spotify, which I find a fantastic way of just stumbling across music. And I encourage my kids to just discover music. And together we came across this song called Take It Easy, which we all just really loved. And I thought, that's interesting. It's kind of maybe aimed at kids, but it's a really good song. And I like the musicianship and the sparseness of it. And there was something about it. I thought, I wonder who this guy is. And then discovered you've done loads of other songs under that name, and then discovered with great interest that you were the lead singer of this band that I thought, I'm sure I know the name of that band. And then when I looked up the songs, I thought, oh yeah, Peaches, I remember that song Peaches. And so how big were you in the US and worldwide?
Well, I think in the end, we sold something like a little over 5 million records worldwide. So at the time, you know, I think we peaked at number 6 on the top 10 in America. And Mio got nominated for a couple of Grammys, so rubbed elbows with people and had adventures and met famous people and played for soul, you know, played giant European festival shows. And then, you know, we broke up for 5 years between 2008 and 2003, and then had another 13-year run where we did it all again. We didn't have the same kind of success, but we
was that 1998 to 2003 you broke up?
Yeah, yeah, early 98.
Sure. Yeah,
or, so, you know, we how big were we? I mean, we were what I like to call, we weren't famous, we were famish. So I like to use that word because it's like we got all the benefits of being well known, but we didn't have any of the hassles or the security threats or, you know.
Okay, the sweet spot.
Yeah, it's a very much a sweet spot where it's a very positive interaction with people that loved us and love us still, but not a safety concern, you know. So
it
couldn't have been better.
Great, great, okay. And so you came to this point of moving on from that to end up writing songs. Would you say that you're writing songs for kids? How would you put it?
You know, I'm really doing it for myself. That those are, I discovered one of the things I think would be interesting to talk about in the context of creativity for all disciplines is knowing yourself, knowing who you are, knowing how you want to live, and, you know, what, you know, who you really are outside of your story, like who, what's your nature, what's your internal sort of happy spot or whatever you want to call it. And mine is being childlike. I like to look at the world as if I'm a child. I like to pretend that trees are frozen explosions and that rocks have inner lives and tears can walk. And, you know, I'm constantly anthropomorphizing everything and making everything come alive. And so the songs are really that. They're me writing songs for me. In fact, when I drive around in Seattle, I listen to my own albums all the time because
because
I made them, and I made them from a place of being.
Why not?
I made them from a place of really representing my true self. So I don't listen to them and cringe because they it's really me. So, I mean, in any discipline you're doing, I think, you know, say if you're making furniture, woodworking, you know, what are you making it for? Are you making like a very a sort of modern, push the boundaries, almost a sculpture chair? Or are you wanting to harken back to a bygone era by, you know, bringing back a technique from the 1600s? And what does that say about you and how you feel about furniture and living spaces? You know, there's all these like switches that can be thrown as a creative person that will lead you to, I would hope, representing your true self. You know, what do you really want to make people feel when they see your work or hear your songs or sit on your chair?
You went very quickly from representing yourself to what you make people feel. I guess, do you feel that's closely connected? You're going to get the most emotional connection with others if you're truest to yourself.
Yeah, well, the source of what I want to make people feel comes from knowing myself. And then the creative output has to represent that. So what I mean is, like, I can write a song and record it and listen back and say, well, it's the wrong tempo because I want people to be able to sway back and forth or dance, you know. So I'm going to adjust the tempo. But the intent of the song comes from an internal, like, message. Like, I want people to, you know, feel what I'm feeling when I sing the song. So, yeah, it's a balance. It's a balance of, like, representing yourself and then also understanding how what you made is going to resonate with others in the world and resonate against, you know, the history of what you're doing.
Okay, so it's not self-absorbed, it's outward, but it comes from your true self.
Yeah, exactly. So you can decide, like, say, I want to make chairs that are beautiful but you can't sit on them, and I want to do that because I want to shake up, I'm anti-tradition, you know, and I want to I want to show people that they're becoming complacent about woodworking and what's possible. So you might make chairs with big spikes in the seat so that nobody can sit in them. And there, somewhere in there is you, and it's also about how other people react to it. So, yeah.
And you're saying that could be just as legitimate as a chair that is designed to be as comfortable as possible, if it's if that's true to what you want to do. And
The other end of the spectrum is you can make it the world's softest chair that is, you know, that nobody ever wants to get out of. We have chairs in our backyard. Actually, they're not fancy woodworking by any means, but they're called gravity chairs. And when you sit in them and you lean back, your legs get supported and your back gets supported in such a way that you feel like you're floating. And those chairs are such a gift because they give you permission to just sit and be still. They don't make you feel, they suddenly make you feel like it's okay to not be achieving anything. And so there's, to me, there's like a, there's a message in the design of that chair that's telling me what the person who made it was. Well, again, these are mass produced. I mean, if, it would be a fun, interesting challenge if somebody were to look at these gravity chairs and then, you know, make a sort of fine woodworking version of one. But anyway, it's just an example of like, it's an example of getting a clear message from a piece of furniture I've experienced.
something being mass produced doesn't necessarily lessen it, because somebody came up with an idea and a prototype, didn't they? And mass production of it is surely all the better in many ways if they can get that out to more people and positively impact their lives.
Yeah, you're right. Well, we have guests over and they sit in these chairs. They're just like, whoa, where did you get this? Well, I'm, they freak out.
So I like to think I'm a creative person, and there'll be people listening to this. They've chosen woodwork because they like to create. It's hard to avoid an element of compromise when you're trying to reconcile that with making a living, finding a buyer. You know, you might have a great idea that you expressing yourself and you think other people would love, but then they don't buy it. So there's always, it's hard to avoid an element of compromise. And I certainly get messages from a lot of people where, on one level or another, I think they're wrestling with that compromise. There's things they want to achieve. They maybe do want to be an heirloom quality hardwood furniture maker, but in the meantime, they've got to pay the bills. And sometimes the work they do to pay the bills leads on to another job that pays the bills, and they get sucked down an avenue. So there are all these things that we need to reconcile. I wonder if, do you think the success you had doing something where you weren't quite aligned with what you really wanted to do, do you think maybe that gave you the freedom then, the exposure, presumably a certain amount of security, to pursue the right thing? Or would you not see it that way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think coming out of the gate, hitting your stride would be an incredibly rare. I mean, it happens. You know, you have people who have a vision from the moment they start that is the right vision, or the vision that connects with others and satisfies their, you know, creative urges, but it's rare. I think it's way more common to just suck for a while and
or to try and be that person and get discouraged and give up.
Sure. And it's, you know, it's a classic cliche, but I think it's worth saying in this context that it's okay to imitate your influences. Just, you know, if you're an artist and you like Picasso, just make something that looks like Picasso and do it over and over until the part of that that's you starts to blossom, you know, take over. So if you're a, you know, if you're a fan of a certain style, just imitate it and then wait for yourself. Like I'm doing that with visual art now. I went to art school and I did these drawings that were abstract, and they were kind of like, they were kind of like Matisse, kind of flowy cutout shape. Excuse me, cutout shapes. But I didn't know what kind of looked like algae. But I didn't know what they were, and I didn't know what the context was. They had no story. And it wasn't until 30 years later, I was in a bookstore and I picked up a book full of Inuit printmaking. These are native people that live on Baffin Island.
Yeah. Okay. In, yeah.
And I looked at this print, this work, and especially one artist, and it just hit me like a bullet. Like, that's what I, you know, what they're doing with those lines is kind of drawing energy around an animal or something. And I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do. So I kind of started out just imitating that art until years later, like I'm talking 7 years later now, I've been playing with these forms. My voice is starting to come out, and I'm starting to find my own vocabulary with those shapes. Okay. So it just, yeah, it's a very valid way to cast about for your destination. And during that time, yeah, it's a struggle. I mean, you'll have to maybe do something else to make your living, or adjust your vision for what you want to do to fit your limitations for a while. And then wait for something to click. But yeah, I think it's for most people a necessary thing. Creativity is hard work. You know, it's just,
yes,
it's just hard work. People think it drops out of the sky, and it does occasionally, but mostly it's the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're reminding me in some ways of a book. There's a book called Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. Have you heard of it?
Hmm. No, I've heard of her.
I think you like it. I don't know. It's always a bit weird just saying you should read this book, but I'll summarize it for you. Then you won't have,
I read a lot of books. I read a lot of books in recommendation too. So.
Okay. Well, so she became a very successful, well-known writer with, it was Eat, Pray, Love. I haven't read it.
Sure.
I had this particular book, Big Magic, recommended to me by someone in a creative field.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about creativity. She's both very down to earth about, for example, the fact that you know, sometimes you just need to get a job and pay your way. Don't expect your creativity to suddenly work out, and don't be this, don't be a martyr to your, don't be this sort of struggling artist your whole life as if there's some virtue in that. But she really believes in what she calls magic, because she thinks the creative process is magical. And she has some amazing stories about that. Like a poet who, I think they lived in a southern state, I'm not sure, but they'd be out in the fields and they would feel a poem rushing towards them, and they would have to run into the house, get a pen and write it before it had been and gone. But sometimes sometimes this poem would come backwards. It's just mad. It's mad. Like really this belief that there is an external force, the muse. And I mean, I don't know where I stand on that. But she has some fascinating stories about creativity just kind of coming to somebody. But she also says you've got to work hard at it, and you can't take that for granted. And that may not happen. That's often very rare. But if you plug away at what you love, then you'll put yourself in the position where it might happen.
Yeah. You're sort of tuned into that channel on the radio or the whatever you want to call it. Like you're tuned into the possibility of a poem coming rushing across the fields. So there it is.
Yeah, because you're there with your pen.
Right.
Yeah,
that's cool. I you know, there is. I definitely think words are magic. I mean, look at what Donald Trump is doing with words. You know, the damage he's doing with words. Look at what Hitler did with words.
Yeah,
he just stood up and said a bunch of words, and bam. In the opposite of a way, you look at what Ram Dass does with words, or Eckhart Tolle.
I don't know them.
Oh, they're like, you know, Eckhart Tolle and Ram Dass are both kind of spiritual gurus, kind of the be here now, live in the moment kind of school of philosophy.
Okay.
And, you know, they also use words to create positive. So you can conjure all kinds of depressed magic with words.
Yeah. Well, words are powerful, because it's what they represent, isn't it? And I suppose creativity, art, anything we create, it's what it represents. And your example of the chair, as makers, I think perhaps particularly in a creative field where you are making something physical and there's quite a lot of technical aspects to it, you can get lost in the technicalities of it, the woodworking joints, the wood finish, etc. But ultimately you're creating something that has a meaning. Hopefully, you know, I suppose there can be just the most basic, ugly chair, which all it's for is for sitting on. But generally, even that, there's
even
you know,
that.
It's a place to rest. It may represent the struggles of somebody's life that they can't afford something better. I don't know. There's always a meaning, isn't there? Whether it's inherent or you can find it. And so, yeah, words are powerful because they conjure up feeling. I mean, yeah, Donald Trump. I mean, we don't want to get too political. The feelings that not his words, but his attitude and his whole, what he represents really, is powerful.
It's powerful because he's playing around with fear. He's trying to use fear. And this is an old political trick to polarize and make people afraid so that they'll turn to you for salvation. And I would hope that day and age, we've been through it so many times with so many leaders. I would hope that we'd become aware of it enough to be like, ah, no. I mean, some people are. And anyway, you'd like to say, I don't want to get too caught up in that. But
yeah,
I mean, I think that words are powerful, but also abstraction is powerful too, because it's takes away sort of the language can be tricky because if I say couch to you, you have a couch in your mind now, right? And everyone listens to a couch in their mind, and every couch is different in everybody's mind.
Mm.
If you abstract a couch, or if you make a couch nobody can sit on, there's a message in that object that is not about words. It's about emotion. You know, like when you traffic in abstraction, you traffic in emotion, and words, you traffic in like sort of context or like the history of the word couch. Like there's so many different ways to visualize couch. But when you abstract a couch or make a couch, it has couchness.
And if you just say it, if you say it often enough, it's just a weird sounding word.
Yeah, couch.
But yes, any word or idea could have a completely different meaning to different people, couldn't it? And we're always navigating that. We don't know if someone else's emotional reaction is anywhere near our own.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why it's kind of cool to make these analogies towards furniture working, because these are things you live with every day, you know, and how you decide on a couch is it's a creative act just buying a couch, really, because it's like trying to find that piece of furniture that expresses who you are as the purchaser, you know, not just as the maker, but there's a creative act in choosing furniture too. And then you're going to look at it a long time, you know, and you're going to, like a sculpture that you lose yourself in or something, or you get to, you get to be a sculpture, which is kind of amazing now that I think about it.
Well, yes. And these objects, these everyday objects, are in many ways as significant a sculpture as something in an art gallery. They're certainly more useful and in many ways more meaningful, aren't they? Somebody's put creative effort into them.
Yeah, so it's a way to have abstract. It's a way, sort of, if you know you're into that, it's kind of a way to have art be part of your life every day. You know, I love that.
Yeah, you mentioned to me earlier.
You're making me want to be a furniture maker now.
Well, I wouldn't really recommend it. So stick with what you're doing.
Okay,
you did say to me earlier that you have an analogy between was it woodworking and songwriting, and you kept me hanging. I didn't hear what it was. I'm interested. What is that?
Well, I always think of when I'm writing a song, like the process of writing it is generally make a big mess and then clean it up kind of thing. So I'll record the song with too many verses, too much instrumentation, too loud, you know, whatever. I just let it be, you know, sort of messy at the beginning. And then I
get it all out there kind of thing.
Get it all out there, feel, you know, and then I kind of go back and I have a mute party where I start muting things, like, okay, that guitar does that really need to be in there? And I generally find when I start getting rid of a lot of the noise, all of a sudden I can really hear the song, like, oh, there it is. And then I start building that song with a woodworking analogy in mind, which is that I feel like in the end, I want to make a really beautiful, small, super tight dovetail joint jewel box. Okay. You know, I want to make something that's like inlaid with mother of pearl and perfectly sanded and totally true and makes a perfect click when you close it. In that, I want all the words and all the melodies and the bass line and the rhythm and everything to kind of be very minimal and very few elements, but just working together like little clockwork, you know, like just right when you need a little support from the bass, there it is. And, you know,
that first song we discovered, Take It Easy, I can totally see that that's what you've done in it.
Right. Because
one of the things I love about it is everything has its place. I think it starts with just your voice, does it?
Gonna bow my fiddle in the forest, bow my fiddle in the wood. Gonna bow my fiddle in the forest so the deers can feel real good. Oh, some say it's easy, so take it easy for me. Gonna bow my fiddle in the forest so the deers can feel real good.
And other things come in and it's
gonna
it's just right.
Pluck my bass in the mountains, pluck my bass on the ground. Gonna pluck my bass in the mountains so the bears make a growly sound.
I actually, with that one, I didn't really make a mess at all because I had in mind, like, I want it to be very sparse.
Gonna pluck my bass in the mountains so the bears make a growly sound.
My original intent with that song was to do the whole thing with just a voice.
Gonna carve my drum from oak or maple, carve my drum from a tree. Gonna carve my drum from oak or maple so the birds can chirp and sing.
Because I saw my dad and I were watching a documentary about a venue here in America called the Grand Ole Opry. It's like a hillbilly music sort of church mecca for country music. And my dad and I watched this documentary and there were a lot of bands playing on it, you know, hillbilly bands, a lot of virtuosity, all these notes, mandolins and violins and banjos. And then all of a sudden this old man came out on stage and just stood all by himself and sang this like lonesome Appalachian ballad. And my dad and I just got goosebumps. And so I thought, I want to go there. I want to try to see if I can inhabit that space.
Oh, some say it's easy, so take it easy for me. Gonna strum my guitar in the city so the babies can all get down. So the birds can chirp and sing. So the fishes can dance with me. So the bears make a growly sound. So the deers can feel real good.
I didn't end up being able to do it because I'm not an old man.
But what you did was true to you, I suppose. I certainly liked it.
But I started out again by trying to imitate something I admired, and then I found myself in it. So that was
interesting. And the fact that you wanted to imitate that and it touched you so much suggests that there was something about that original performance that was true to you as well. And you had to.
Yeah. And that's an important thing. I'm really interested in when you get a sense of familiarity with somebody else's creativity. You know, you look at it and think, oh, yeah, I know that. That makes so much sense. That's inevitable. I mean, of course that exists. Of course that sound of his voice comes out of there because it's like the sound of humanity. Or to bridge the gap with woodworking, it's like, of course, fundamentally a chair is a chair because of our bodies, you know, and there's an inevitability to a chair.
There's only so much, I suppose, that you can mess with the design before it's not really a chair anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's all kind of, it's interesting. I like that. I like to try to work that sense of inevitability into my own music by paying attention to old music. Because I kind of feel like if a nursery rhyme or a work song or a chant kind of makes, or a children's nursery rhyme kind of has survived for hundreds of years through oral tradition, that it's probably got something that's essentially human in it. And then I'll take it and kind of make it into something my own. So anyway.
And so this word inevitability. So are you talking about things that seem just right as they are? Nothing needs to be added or removed.
Right. And you get the sensation like, well, of course that's, of course you did that because that is
to the point you can almost take that creative work for granted and not it's I don't know. So sometimes I think the best design you don't realize how great it is because the designers arrived at something that is just fit.
Yeah.
Just how it should be. Inevitable, I suppose.
Yeah. It's inevitable.
A lot of what you're saying reminds me of something that an architecture lecturer said to me. I went from architecture training into woodwork. And in one of our first lectures in the first year, this design tutor said, simplicity is on the far side of complexity.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. So this idea that if you come at a design problem, I don't know if you see a song as a design problem. It's probably, I don't know.
I could.
It's a bit different. I suppose a song is less constrained than woodwork by practicalities. Or is that unfair to say?
No, I think it's as constrained, definitely. And again, it depends. Well, okay. Neither are constrained at all, but they are once you start defining what you want the user to experience, right? So if I want a family to feel like nurtured and taken care of and told a story and rocked out gently to a song, then that immediately narrows my options, right?
See,
and if you want to make a couch or a chair or a dresser that's functional and affordable, that narrows your options like immediately. So I think you have to visualize the destination in order to understand the path to it, you know?
Yes. And they say that about life, don't they? You just visualize and achievement and sport and everything. Visualize what you want to do and your body and your mind sort of come in line. But if we think of it as a design problem, certainly most of my work, my woodwork, in some way or another is a design problem. I'm trying to reconcile what the customer wants in terms of what they want to store in this cupboard and the look they want, which might be about making their neighbors envious, or it might just be about really enjoying their space so it looks like a magazine, with my particular set of abilities, which are limited, and the materials I have access to, and a budget. And so this idea of simplicity being beyond complexity, or sometimes a challenge can seem very complex and difficult, and you have to work through a lot of iterations of, is this going to work? And it doesn't quite hit the spot on the budget, perhaps. But very often, after a lot of trial and error and design, the solution is very simple, but it doesn't always present itself straight away. And I find it very satisfying when that happens. And I always like to think in those terms. I suppose another theme that I pick up from talking to you is I feel that you've been able to set aside the ambition and arrogance that can come from wanting to achieve, I suppose, for others, wanting to achieve something creative for the approval of others, rather than now you're talking about being true to yourself. I've just lost my train of thought. But we can complicate things so much. And what I was trying to say is you can think that more complex is better. I think perhaps some of us, when we're young, we think that if we're learning the piano or something, we want to impress with lots of fast notes.
Yeah.
But the real skill is in choosing the notes that just fit and touch you, perhaps, and nothing more.
Well, that is interesting, but that gets into area I've thought about a lot, which is virtuosity. You know, what is virtuosity saying to the person who is either looking at or listening to your creative output? And there are brains out there who are tickled by virtuosity. You know, like a lot of notes and a lot of skill is what makes them go, yeah, that, oh yeah, that feels good. But then there are other people who want to hear maybe four notes played exactly perfectly, and they'll get off on that. So again, I think it's all a matter of your vision and your choice about who you're, about what your destination is. You know, do you want people to look up at you and go, oh my God, I could never do that. You are better than me. You're separate from me. Mm. And this is not a judgment. This is just like a color in the paint box, you know, like, do you want to choose simplicity or do you want to choose virtuosity? But yeah, I think maybe you're right. Like when you're younger, you're more ambitious and you think like more is better. And then you get older and you might understand, you might start to see the beauty of simplicity. But, you know, everybody's different in that regard, in that art.
True.
Yeah. So I look at it as just, I mean, personally, I display a kind of virtuosity as a songwriter and a recording engineer and producer and everything, because my virtuosity is about playing less and removing.
Yeah.
And, or maybe crafting the perfect guitar solo, which doesn't mean it's flashy. It just means it's like melodic and kind of has the right sound. And maybe an invisible hidden virtuosity in minimal. That is, you know, it's like the anti-virtuosity.
I agree, and it's the courage to simplify and remove. And some people don't. I think some people don't have the courage.
Yeah,
it's because it can feel exposed.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree. But then you know what? On the other, it can feel exposed, but I feel like I actually do all that work to feel less exposed. I feel like if I do all the work and make the song a perfect little jewel box with dovetail joints that clicks perfectly when it closes, then it's indefensible. Like I can release it and be like, there's nothing I could do to this. My work is done. Like how it resonates with the world is totally up to the song now, you know?
I'm finding this very interesting. I do hope others are listening and finding it interesting too. You never quite know. Cause I have gone a bit off piste with, you know, people expect me to be just talking about woodwork, but we're touching on it, I think, in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
And it only really occurs to me now. I think that the theme of this chat is creativity, isn't it? I haven't quite settled on that as a clear thing. So something else that I thought might be a theme was mental health. Now, I just bring that up, so that seems out of the blue, but a lot of the best feedback I get on my social media. So I do a bit of YouTubing, Instagram, bit of blog writing, these podcasts, and sometimes I touch on mental health, or sometimes I'm just honest about making mistakes. And some of the most enthusiastic feedback I get is from people saying, I'm so glad you said that, because sometimes I feel like no one else makes these mistakes, or sometimes I feel like it's just me having these feelings or whatever. And for me, this is all part of the picture of people, creative people, trying to reconcile being true to themselves, which is a struggle sometimes, making a living, trying to do something meaningful. Some of us find ourselves in jobs that just don't feel meaningful. You know, hopefully having some kind of a positive impact on the world. And the world is a scary place at the moment. And something I've found with your songs is that they are like a little oasis of joy. And to me, they are very significant. And I remember sending you an email when you know, the world was looking particularly bad. I mean, it still is, but I can't remember what exactly was in the news. But I was feeling particularly discouraged, and Trump was part of the mix for me. And I remember just dropping you a little email saying, if I could think of the exact opposite of Donald Trump, it would be one of your songs. and you wrote back to me saying it really encouraged you, and I got the sense from your reply that you were just looking around to know that what you were doing had some kind of meaning and impact. And I just wondered your take on, you know, keeping sane in this world, and I don't know why I'm asking really, but any thoughts on mental health?
Oh, I do absolutely have thoughts on that. I think what's super important is there's a couple things. One is identify what's inside and outside your sphere of influence.
Okay.
You know, look around at what you can change and try to release what you can't change, as something that you have no control over. And part of that is being in the moment, like understanding that your story and the potential threats to your safety and your sanity are things that are happening mm-hmm. to you. They are not who you are. They're part of your story. And behind your story is you as just a being that's existing, and that mm-hmm. is the same as every other being that's existing at this moment. There's a sameness and a unity to that experience. There's an exercise you can do where you look at your finger and if you're freaking out, look at your finger and try to imagine the energy inside your finger and really focus on that energy. And now look at your other fingers and imagine the energy inside your other fingers, and then go to your hand and then your arm and then your other hand and arm and then your legs. And pretty soon, if you do that, you really hold that visualization of the energy inside your body, your story goes quiet. And you have a moment where, or maybe a series of moments where you are free of, the story of the world, the story of your life, all that stuff. And from that place, you can hopefully, get to know yourself better, as just a person sitting, not trying to achieve anything. And then from
mindfulness,
from there you get to know yourself a little bit better, and then you can figure out how to be creative without it being who you are. And
interesting.
I think people when they get wrapped up in that, they get fearful, because what if they lose it? I don't know Mick Jagger, but I wonder if there's an element of fear of giving up on being Mick Jagger and just not dancing around at the age of 75. But again, I'm not trying to judge Mick Jagger. I don't know. Sure. He's a different human than me, for sure. Anyway, so there's...
Maybe that's just who he is. It is interesting, though, that you are talking about separating you from your story.
Right.
So in some ways, I think our story, people's stories in general, are significant, are what connects us to each other. I heard a phrase some time ago that said the most personal is the most universal. So if you're wanting to connect through a creative work or something you write or whatever with other people, if your starting point is what are they thinking and what's going to work for them, it's actually never going to resonate as well as if you go deep into, well, what really has resonated with me? And because that will resonate with other people, even if they don't completely relate.
Well, maybe
because of its authenticity. Go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, maybe a fine point on that would be think about what relates to the humanness inside you, not your story.
Yes, I suppose interesting. So it's almost what you're going deeper. You're going, what's really underneath the story? Or even what's there if there was no story?
Yeah.
If I make
a piece of music that feels like it's taking care of the universal human in me, then it will take care of the universal human in everybody, other people. And I think that's why the Casper Baby Pants music works for so many families. I mean, I get just so many emails from people, like grateful emails saying it's like connecting their family through the love of these songs.
Yeah.
They feel like,
I could say that.
Yeah, like taken care of. And I think it's because I'm trying to take care of the universal part of me.
I made a hole down under the grass, and the moles in their holes say hi as I dig right past. I do not cry or worry a lot, 'cause a hole in the grass is all that I have got. All that I have got.
I'm not trying to be famous or be well known, being clever or whatever. In fact, I'm not in any of my videos on purpose. I have a pseudonym on purpose.
Are you not? We thought there's a video with a baby in it, and we thought it looked a bit like you. It's lots of Polaroid type snaps.
That's me. That's me as a baby. Yes.
Oh, that is you. Okay, caught you out there.
It's really, you know, it's baby me. So.
Yeah, it's a bit different though, isn't it? Yeah, there's not a lot of ego in putting baby pictures of yourself.
No, I'm not trying to emulate that look anymore. But yeah, the point is I've consciously tried to remove me and my story from the Casper thing, and I'm trying to, and I don't spend any money on promotion at all. I just make the music and release it, and I don't really do anything. I do, you know, if people ring me up and want me to be on their podcast, I say yes. But other than that, I do nothing. And my theory is I just want to let the music do the work and find its way slowly from family to family, in a real way where families are really telling other families, like, you got to check this out. That's invaluable. So I just let I let the work speak for itself and do the work. You know, I put all my effort into making it and not into promoting it. So,
I like that.
Yeah.
I was going to say that resonates with me. I find myself in a position where I just do now promote, and it's never come naturally to me. Both my woodwork to make it a viable business and to some extent the online work that I do, which comes out of wanting to help other people and things. Although I sometimes question that motive, and I read something, what was it? I read it talking about that. The whole idea of it. No, it was Elizabeth Gilbert in Big Magic. And she said something about when someone says they want to help you, you just want to run, you want to run a mile. But if someone is just being themselves and you know it's real and that connects with you, then you're open to their positive influence. So right. I often think about that, but yeah, the whole thing of promotion, I love how you say it. I love the idea that something can be done so well and so authentically that it will just slowly but surely spread.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's okay. And let it spread in its own time, in its own way.
Exactly. I really wanted to run that experiment with the rock band back in the day, but I was the only one that wanted to try it. So. But I do remember saying to the major label people in the promotion department and all that, like, can we promote the band without appearing to promote the band at all? Is there any way to do that? And they're like, no, we just got to promote the band. But anyway, I got to that. One of the beautiful things about getting through with that and getting on to the Casper Baby Pants thing, where I'm the only person in charge of all those decisions, is that my promotional strategy meetings are very short. You know, like, it's just me and I go, do I want to do that? Nope. Okay.
And so what role does your wife have in it? I only learned recently that your wife does those wonderful childlike pictures that form the album covers.
Yeah.
Do you have very defined roles? Do you collaborate a lot on the whole project, or does she do the art, you do the songs?
No, you know, she's co-written a whole bunch of songs with me. She's been an influence as far as me getting back into making visual art. You know, we do books together where we write this books together, and then she illustrates it and I write a song, and the song is paced to be listened to while you read the book. And
so
We have four or five books out where you can cuzzle down, cuzzle, that's our word for cuddle on the couch. You can cuzzle down with your kid and listen to the song while you read the book. I've purposely like paced the song so they're not too fast, so you can enjoy the book.
And so these are physical paper books that I could buy on Amazon or elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
In England, you think? Yeah,
I'm sure you can. Yeah, they should be. I mean, my wife will ship them to you. You can get them on her website. Her name,
which is, why don't you just plug that now? Yeah.
Yeah, her name is Kate Endel. Her last name is E-N-D-L-E. So it's kateendel.com, and just go from there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. I'll check it out.
Okay. Yeah, it's great stuff. Her artwork is, I mean, talk about imitating something to find your voice. I mean, I saw her artwork. I just went, I want to make music that comes from that planet. And I just did it. I just started making music that felt like it was living in the same world with your visuals, and then all of a sudden I went, oh, it's kids music, that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
So is that right? So seeing her art prompted the whole Caspar Baby Pants project.
Exactly. I wanted to make music that made me feel like I felt when I looked at her art. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It wouldn't have existed without her art.
That's great. Okay. It just came to mind to ask you now, why the name Caspar Baby Pants?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a nickname that I had in Boston in the early 90s. I was in a band with a friend, and it was an improvisational band, and it was very fun. People would write down song titles on napkins and pass them to us, and we would make them up on the spot. And my stage name during that thing was Caspar Baby Pants. I wore a pair of baby's pants on my head as a winter hat during that phase, and the kids in my neighborhood started calling me Baby Pants. I'd been making little weird cassettes as Casper for years before that in the late 80s and 90s. So I became Casper Baby Pants back in 1991. And then when I was sitting around trying to figure out what to call this kids music thing, I remembered that old nickname and was like, oh, well, it's another breadcrumb along the way. I'm already Casper Baby Pants. So there you go.
Yeah. And I suppose this whole thing of being true to yourself, finding your voice, I guess pulling up something from the past that's been there for a while.
Yeah.
It has a story, meaning.
And I like names. I like having names for projects that make people smile when you say them. You know, like when back in the day, people would say, what's your band called? And I'd say, the Presidents of the United States of America. They would laugh. I could barely say.
Did you come up with that name?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
It just
felt so incongruous and unrelated and ridiculous. You know,
and the fact that it's so long, it's not just the Presidents.
Oh yeah, no, love. Yeah. It's like 17 syllables or something. So yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, I was very proud of that name. I loved part of it was, you know, when we started out, we were this dorky little duo. It was me and Dave, and then Jason joined. And
in
the early days, we were just these dorks trying to rock. You know, and to say from the stage, we are the Presidents of this grandiose name for this like dinky little stupid band. That was, to me, hilarious. So,
well, I'm really looking forward to promoting this podcast, saying I'm interviewing an ex-president of the United States of America.
That's right. That's right.
that might be all I say.
Yeah. Yeah. Teaser.
See what. Yeah. Exactly. So, how was it? College friends, school friends, college friends that you started the band with? How did it start?
Well, it was just another in a long series of experiments with, you know, different lineups, different people. Some of the same songs would kind of hop from band to band. So from the time I went to college in the early 80s till the Presidents came together, it was just a series of, you know, different configurations and bands. And Presidents were just another one of those. And just, it was a kid, Dave Dieterer, that I went to high school with, and he had a friend, Jason Finn. And so Dave and I had been playing since the mid 80s as a duo, acoustic duo, kind of like a Simon and Garfunkel but with a, you know, a surrealistic tongue in cheek kind of folky poppy thing. And we just kind of started doing that again, in the, you know, early 90s but doing it electric and playing shows and clubs. And then Jason begged to be our drummer, and we said, okay, we don't really need a drummer, but okay. And then, you know, it just,
so you were quite into the minimal at the time, would you say, the simple?
Oh yeah.
Definitely. Or was that not how you saw it? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We were playing 3-string guitars at that point. Dave and I, in the 80s, we played 2 6-string acoustic guitars, but yeah, when we got to the 90s, I had adopted the 2 and 3-string thing. And
I didn't know you were doing it back then, because I read, is all the Caspar Baby Pants music done on a 3-string guitar? Is that right? Or is that not?
It's 2-string, 3-string, piano, bass, 2-string bass. There's a couple of 6-string guitars in there just a couple times, but mostly it's a 3-string guitar. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, it certainly works. And for anybody out there listening who's interested in the music and thinks their kids might like it, I'm sure they will. There's a fantastic app called Music Time, which I was very impressed with when we discovered. It looks like you've put a lot of work into that.
Yeah, that was an app developer that just kind of almost bullied us into making it, because we were like, we don't need an app. And he's like, no, you need an app, you need an app. And we haven't actually heard from him for quite a while, so I don't think he's ingested new albums into it, but it's called Casper Music Time. And it is, yeah, it's a way to play little instruments along with the
It's brilliant. And I'm sure there are people listening to this. I hear from woodworkers who are also musicians. I know a few. And I'm sure they, like me, would love their kids to get into music and want to find a way to encourage them to. Now, for us as a family, just having your songs on, it's turned our kids' minds onto music. They're really engaged with it. And then to discover this app, what's so nice about it is all the songs that are on there, it gives you the chord that's being played. And it's got this clever feature where if you're choosing the guitar, the keyboard, or there's a sort of marimba type thing, you can just tap away at the notes, but they actually change to only be the notes that fit with that chord.
Yes.
And it's very good. I mean, I've tried so many kids' music apps, and it's really one of the best. So are you saying you didn't have that much input? This developer just came up with it.
Oh, no. When he kind of bullied us into getting started, like, you know, we got to do an app. Okay. And then we kind of sat down and figured it out together. Like, I'm very much adamant about any music thing that a kid is controlling has to sound pleasant, because parents will suffer. You know, I actually have this idea for a one string guitar for babies, where it would be one string guitar that would have a built-in speaker that you could turn on and then turn way up to distortion levels, so a baby could rock out. It'd be a decent sized string. It wouldn't be like a plinky plonky string. And then the frets would be staggered in such a way that it would be a scale, so you would never hit a bum note. One string means it's never out of tune, and the frets being staggered like a dulcimer mean it would never be anything but a pleasant relationship between the notes they're hitting. So I've had that idea.
Well, if you ever want to take this idea further, I would happily prototype it with Isaac. I'm sure he'd love it.
Well, yeah, that could be interesting. My son is actually a guitar repairer and guitar builder, and I keep bothering him like, hey, man, why don't we together? But, you know, he doesn't want to work on a project with his dad, I guess.
How old is your son?
He's 23.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any other kids?
I do. I have a daughter named Josie who's 19.
Yeah.
She's she's in college in Colorado. So Augie lives in a town about 2.5 hours north of Seattle, and Josie's in Colorado. So I'm empty nesting it.
But still making it, because I think I sort of imagined you surrounded by little kids. I thought, well, it's probably too old for that now. With the music you make, but as you said, you make this music for you. And touching on something you said about it, how people react to it, I just wanted to say that I think one of the powerful things about it is that you don't listen to it and feel that you're being taught something,
right?
Educated, or either about music or morality or anything like that. It is just good music that's fun and silly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't demand anything of you.
Right.
And no, I think that's why it works so well.
Yeah. I definitely want to be what I call generous. There's an aspect of songwriting I call generosity, where I want to make it so that people can walk away from a song after hearing it once, and they have the melody and the visual ingested into their minds and bodies, you know, so that they can walk down the street. Now they own the song in a way. They can like walk down the street and enjoy it any old time, because it's been engineered, I guess, to be easily ingested into people's, like, you know, systems.
Great.
Or whatever.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think as a final thing.
Yeah.
If there are any woodworkers listening to this who are in that place of not quite getting it together with the work they want to do being enjoyable, paying the bills, making a difference, what would be your main bits of advice as one creative person to another, just trying to get that balance and that satisfaction in life and work?
Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Okay. Don't feel like you have to figure it out by the end of the day today. Pick one thing right now that will make you happy. Whether it's just sitting down to make a sketch of something you've always wanted to build. Take one step toward your, take one step toward your, take one step every day that makes you feel happy, I guess. Just do one thing every day that makes you feel good. And check in with yourself about how you feel about what you're doing. Like if you sit down to do something you're currently working on, take a second, just sit back and go, how do I feel about this? Is this really what I want to do? And it's a yes or a no. And try to take the yes fork in the road and be like, if it's no, try something, tweak it a little, try something else. Try to move your answer toward the left, or not left, but the yes side of the forks in the road as you check in from moment to moment with yourself. So bite off small chunks, check in for how you're feeling in your body often, and take those yes forks until you reach what I like to call, wait for it, drum roll please, your yes-tination.
Oh, good. Yeah, okay.
The yes-tination is what you get after you say yes to... you get to a point where everything you're doing feels right and you're just like yes. You know what Yoko Ono wrote? I mean, the reason John Lennon and Yoko Ono ended up together is that when John climbed the ladder in the art gallery where Yoko had a show, he climbed up this ladder and there's a magnifying glass at the top of the ladder and a very tiny little word written on the ceiling. And you get the magnifying glass and you look, and the word was yes. And that's when John was like, okay, who is this person? I need to be around this. I love that. Yeah.
And I love that we've started and finished with the Beatles.
Yes.
So that feels like an appropriate place to wrap it up.
It does.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed that. I do hope others did as well. I think they probably would have done.
Yeah, I hope all your listeners aren't sitting at home just shaking their heads like, nope.
I know. There is this part of me thinking there's going to be some people going, why isn't he talking about woodwork? But we did talk about woodwork.
We did. Yeah.
And much more beside.
Sure.
And I hope that it brings some more families to know your music and take delight in it as our family does.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate you helping me spread the word, because like I said, you're all I've got.
Our current favorite song, All That I Have Got. I love that song.
There you go. There, that's the yes. I love that one too.
All that I have got.
The other one I would recommend, if anyone's going to listen to one song right now, I think it's on Jump for Joy, the album Jump for Joy. It's called I Feel Better. And
I haven't listened to that for a while, but I vaguely remember it. I want to listen to it again now. Go on. What are you going to say about it?
Well, I listened to that song to remind myself that it's basically the gist of the song is this too shall pass. Right now you might feel shitty, but this too shall pass. This too shall pass. So that's I took this too shall pass and I wrapped it up in a late 70s kind of, Commodore's vibe.
what would be your choice of song to end with?
I think I Feel Better. Yeah.
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 Okay.
I feel better. You know I do. I feel better. And you will too. I feel better, better, better. My record album sat in the sun. It got all warpy, and that was no fun. I felt bad then, but now I feel better. My sandcastle was made out of sand. It fell apart when I touched it with my hand. I felt bad then, but now I feel better. Did tumble and shatter. In the future, things like that glass don't matter. I felt bad then, but now I feel better. I rode my bike over nails in the street. Two flat tires made me sad and angry. I felt bad then, but now I feel better.